Other evidence that more employers are hiring, first-time unemployment claims are down by 5,000 to a seasonally adjusted 382,000. Defense Secretary Robert Gates' plans to push for Israeli-Palestinian peace may run into more resistance today. He's in Israel a day after a bomb exploded at a bus stop in Jerusalem. A British tourist died from her injuries. As many as 30 people were wounded. Gates is expected to press the U.S.'s case that peace negotiations are the best way to get ahead of the wave of uprisings spreading across the Arab world. The unrest further complicates Israel's security agreements with countries such as Egypt and Jordan, where people are demanding sweeping political change. I'm Lakshmi Singh, NPR News, Washington.
Support for NPR comes from the Skoll Foundation, supporting social entrepreneurs and their innovations to solve the world's most pressing problems at skoll.org.
On the next Fresh Air, how pizza, pasta, and olive oil came to America. Food writer John Mariani talks about his new book, How Italian Food Conquered the World. Mariani is also the author of the Encyclopedia of American Food and Drink, and he writes about food for Esquire magazine. Join us.
Today at 1 p.m. and 7 p.m. on AM 580.
The 2011 vintage vinyl sale is coming up on Saturday, April 30th. Start packing your used CDs, records, DVDs, tapes, and working stereo equipment now. And beginning April 4th, drop them off at any Busey Bank office in Champaign, Urbana, or Savoy. Call me, Dean Geiken, at 217-333-6503 for more information.
This is Focus, our morning talk program. It's hour two of the show. I'm David Inge. Harriet Williamson is our producer. The following program comes from the Focus archive, so that means that for the next hour, we will not be taking your calls. Over the past few decades, the ways that Americans think about family and work and gender have all changed dramatically. In this hour of our show, we will try to look at how these changes have shaped the attitudes of young people who have grown up during that time. And the guest for the program is Kathleen Gerson. She is professor of sociology and collegiate professor at New York University. And this subject, that is family change, is something that she has done a lot of research and writing about. And some of it you will find in a recently published book. And the title of her book is The Unfinished Revolution, How a New Generation is Reshaping Family, Work, and Gender in America. It's published by the Oxford University Press and has recently been published. She's the author of a couple of books. She frequently contributes to media, including New York Times, Wall Street Journal, Washington Post. She's been interviewed on National Public Radio, CNN, and we're pleased that she could spend some time talking with us this morning. Professor Gerson, hello.
Good morning.
Well, thank you very much for talking with us today.
It's my pleasure. I'm delighted.
And this is something I should make the point here that this area, this kind of research, is something that you've been involved in now for a number of years. And that what you have done and what people will find in the book is the result of your spending time interviewing young people who grew up during this time, trying to talk with them a little bit about what their experiences were in the family of their family of origin, and then perhaps also getting at some of their thoughts about what kind of family then they think they want to have.
Exactly. Yes, I have been studying this for many years. I'm afraid I'm several generations removed from younger generations, so I've been looking at these changes for a very long time.
Yeah, and I don't know that we really need to spend too much time enumerating these changes, but just to touch on them briefly, we're talking about several things, and maybe the most significant change that we have seen now over the past couple of decades is the growth in the number of two-earner families.
Correct. Some historians say that we've seen more family change in the last three decades than we've seen in the recorded human history up to this point. That might be a slight exaggeration, but nevertheless, I think it does point out just the degree to which we now take for granted family forms and ways of living that seemed all but unimaginable three decades ago.
Mm-hmm.
And yes, you're correct. The most common family form today, if you were to simply take a snapshot of the American population, is a two-earner couple, The second most populated family form is the single-parent family, and way back is what we used to call the traditional family of married couple with one earner, primarily the male breadwinner. And that particular family form now accounts for less than 15% of American households.
And of the single-parent homes, most of these are headed by women.
Correct. Although I would also hasten to point out that there is a bit of a misunderstanding even about those homes, because it turns out that we are now beginning to find out that even homes that look like they're single-parent homes, especially if we look at the census, often do contain two parents. They're simply not legally married and may not get counted that way in the census. Certainly relationships have become much more fluid, much more changeable. Children today, even more than thinking of families as snapshots, children today are more likely to grow up in households that are changing over time and moving in and out of different family forms.
And that's, I guess, again, one of the significant points. Now, I think people are very concerned about divorce rates, and that may be significant. We also, though, do see significant rates of remarriage. So not only is the possibility that you might live with just one parent for a while, but it's also very possible that you might find yourself with stepmom, stepdad, stepbrothers and sisters, and that you might spend your time at different times along the year with different families and be connected some way with more than one family, more than one grouping.
Absolutely. Most marriages that break up, those couples remarry. Marriage remains a very popular form of living in this society, and we can see that by the strong movement for gay marriage, which I think attests to the popularity of marriage. Even in a period when people have so many options not to marry, ironically, we tend to see marriage as, even because it's more chosen and it's not something everyone has to do, we see it as even more precious and more important. One other thing I would point out, with all of the talk about divorce and family breakup, I do think it's important to remember, first, that divorce rates have actually declined over the last several decades. They rose very quickly during the 70s and 80s and then tended to plateau, and if anything, have fallen off a bit today. For several reasons, I think people are more likely to postpone marriage, and the awareness of divorce has made young people much more careful in some ways about entering a legal bond with someone, although, of course, cohabitation rates have gone up. But the other thing to keep in mind for those who are concerned about family change is that well over half of all marriages never break up. Most marriages do last, and this is in a period in which people are living longer than ever. 100 to 150, 200 years ago, most marriages broke up because someone died. Today, as we're living so long, there's very low rates of death through childbirth and all the other dangers that led to death hundreds of years ago. So the marriages that last are really, really quite strong, considering how long they last and the fact that people have so many other options.
Mm-hmm. Very quickly, let me again introduce our guest for this hour of Focus 580. Kathleen Gerson is professor of sociology at New York University, and we are talking about some of what you'll find in the book, The Unfinished Revolution, How a New Generation is Reshaping Family Work and Gender in America. It's published by the Oxford University Press, pulling together some research that she's been involved in actually now for a long time, looking at these changes in family structure and what they have meant for people who were born and grew up, let us say, over the last 20 years or so. And questions are welcome, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455, and email will-talk@illinois.edu. As we have discussed, probably the big change, it has been the move to the two-earner family, and this seemed to be a major topic of concern particularly for people whose frame of reference was the nuclear family of the immediate post-war period, which some people, I think, actually would argue was an anomaly in terms of American family history.
Correct. We often refer to this as the gender revolution, and what we mean by that is that women today are as likely as men to be in the labor force, and that includes married women with young children. And so this has not only produced a revolution at home where we now have two earners and working mothers, but it's produced a revolution in the workplace as well. So if from the vantage point of the 1950s, this is truly a massive social change. Mm-hmm. It is important, however, to point out that the 50s were, in their own way, an anomaly. The so-called, ideal American suburban family that grew up in the 50s was really the result of a very short-lived economic and social boom that occurred right after World War II. So in many ways, it's sort of backwards to the future. We're returning to an economic system in which adults participate both in the workplace and at home, whether or not they're a man or a woman. Nevertheless, it is a revolution because the workplace now is separate from the home. People leave their homes to go to work, and this changes the dynamic in a home in a very different way than, say, when family farms predominated and work and home were so closely connected. So that now what young people are facing is very strong, deep conflicts between their economic responsibilities and their commitments to self-development and autonomy at work, and their family responsibilities for taking care of their children, not just economically but emotionally, and being a member of a working, committed, dynamic relationship in which work doesn't have to come first all the time.
One of the big questions, and I'm sure that it continues to be debated, is what is the effect on children of having a mom mm-hmm. who works outside the
right.
home? And is that good or bad or otherwise? So,
and
particularly I'm interested in, you know, your experience talking mm-hmm. with people and asking them, well, what did you think? As far as you were concerned, was this good, bad, or otherwise?
Well, here's the really good news from my research. We have spent so much time wringing our hands about the potential dangers of having employed mothers. And in fact, what I found is that young adults who grew up during this period of rapid revolutionary change are overwhelmingly supportive of working mothers. Men and women alike, over 90% felt that their mothers did the right thing by working. In contrast, and this is another very surprising finding, among those young people whose mothers stayed home, they were about evenly divided between those who felt their mothers made the right decision to stay home and those who had wished that their mothers had chosen a different option. The question is why? And the answer is pretty simple. Among those young people whose mothers worked, they could see the benefits, both the economic benefits to the family, even to the point of giving their fathers more freedom and more options, and they saw the emotional benefits to their mothers, who had a certain amount of autonomy as a result of their working. And this had ripple effects throughout the home. Now, I hasten to add that a number of these children, about 20 to 25%, were also quite concerned with the burden, the double burden of being having to work both full-time at home and full-time at work, and the stress that placed on mothers and other family members. But mostly they attributed these negative consequences to employers who were not able and willing to give more flexibility, or to sort of recalcitrant husbands who didn't pick up the slack at home. So, but even given those problems, most children with a working mother were happy to have had one. And, of course, this is especially true if they had separated or divorced parents or single mothers.
I find myself, again, thinking that this is a very interesting finding, but it may be not so surprising that for people who had a mother who felt very strongly that her career was important to her, that,
right.
that working was important. You know, maybe you wouldn't be real surprised that kids would say, yeah, that was a good thing. I
right.
find myself, though, going back to those people who had a mom who stayed at home, who there sort of thought it was kind of a toss-up
exactly.
between whether that was the best thing or
right.
something otherwise would have they thought would have been better.
Yes, I think that's the side of the equation that we really don't pay enough attention to. I think the general cultural belief is that mothers should sacrifice for their children, that it's better if they do, or that mothers are ultimately fulfilled by staying home. And it turns out that neither of those assumptions pans out in about half the cases. So for those children whose mothers actually were happy staying home, who did not have a great desire to have a career, and most importantly, had stable marriages in which fathers had good jobs that brought in a good income, they were happy with their situation, and that's the situation we tend to assume. However, over about half of the people I interviewed didn't have that situation. Quite the opposite. In these cases, mothers had given up careers and jobs that had been very important to them because they thought it was in the best interest of their children, and ultimately became very dissatisfied and frustrated at home. Often this got combined with a father who hit unexpected roadblocks in his own work, and rather than being able to somehow make an adjustment because of those breadwinning responsibilities, felt he too was stuck. And in these situations where mothers or fathers or both felt stuck in roles that just didn't fit and just didn't work, but nevertheless, for cultural and psychological and emotional reasons, they felt they had to stick it out. The children really perceived that. Children are experts on their parents' emotional state. And when that happened, the children were, in fact, dissatisfied. They even expressed guilt that somehow their parents had made sacrifices for them that hadn't been necessary and hadn't worked out in the end.
There's some other findings here that you present that I think are really interesting, and this has to do with parental breakup.
Mm-hmm.
And for kids who came through an experience where their parents divorced, and whether or not they thought that was good or not. And there, as you report in the book, I think there is this overwhelming idea that children always believe it would be better to have their parents together, even if things weren't so hot, than to have their parents separate. And what you found was that, in fact, there is no clear opinion among these young people who grew up in these families that it would have been better for their parents to stay together.
Right. Again, another real surprise to me. And very similar to the findings on working mothers. Everyone agrees, and I don't know anyone who would disagree, that all things being equal, of course it's better to have two parents who are happily married. The problem, of course, in situations where parents break up, and often, I'm sorry to say, in situations where they don't, things aren't equal. Happily married couples don't break up. And so then the question becomes, what, from the child's point of view, what is the best option under those very difficult circumstances? And here again, I found that while about slightly more than half did feel that they wished their parents had stayed together despite all the difficulties, almost half felt that under the circumstances, they had made the right choice, and that both parents, or at least one parent, had gone on to rebuild their lives in a better way as a result of having broken up with the parent, the first parent.
And if you look at the other sort of situation where maybe it was not a great marriage, but the parents stayed together, there, yeah, it's something like looks
right.
like a, you know, maybe in the low 50s said yes, they thought that it was a good thing
right.
for their parents stayed together, but that here again, substantial numbers said, you know, maybe that really wasn't the best thing.
Exactly. Now, you know, it's, of course, children are to a certain extent playing Monday morning quarterbacking with their parents, mm-hmm. and I'm not suggesting that these are somehow objective measures, but it is true that this is how they feel, and it's how they see their family life and the kind of lessons that they are taking into the future. And again, and just to reiterate, among that group in which the parents did stay together, absolutely, when the parents appeared happy, economically stable, of course the children felt this was absolutely the best thing to do. But sadly, there were many cases in which children felt that their parents had been ill-suited for each other. Perhaps they'd married too young. They didn't know themselves very well when they chose to get married. Perhaps they'd married for, quote-unquote, the wrong reasons. Or perhaps they just found out after they were married that things did not work out. But when there were high levels of conflict in the home, in some cases involving, you know, emotional and even physical abuse, but and not many, however, but when there were high levels of conflict and dissatisfaction and the parents still stuck it out for the sake of the children, those children were inclined to say, you know, they didn't have to do this for me, and they probably would have been better off had they pursued a different path, and I probably would have been as well. So again, children are very perceptive, and when they perceive conflicts, they don't necessarily say staying together is always best for the kids.
We have a caller. Let's talk with him in Indiana on our line 4. Hello.
Hello. You mentioned at the beginning that only 15% of the relationships were like we're led to believe everything should be, mother, father, and a child. That really surprised me, although I'm not, you know, that backward thinking that things hadn't changed, but I didn't think it was that large.
Oh, well, let me correct that. I meant a breadwinning father and a stay-at-home mother. That is only 15% of American households.
That still astounds me. When I start thinking about it and look around the houses by me, I think something particularly unique about myself. But it is more than, it is something like that. But it's still pretty low. So I wondered if you could take the time to comment about the other percentages of the groupings and say something about them also.
Sure.
I came through the golden age, the 50s. My mother and father were divorced and both remarried and all that sort of thing. I found myself basically on my own. Neither one was particularly interested in, you know, rearing me in some sense.
Mm-hmm.
And I was wondering about that dichotomy between what we are supposed to do, get married after we graduate from high school and have kids, and what actually was going on then, because I had friends that got married simply just to have sex. And a few months later, they discovered they didn't like each other at all. There were all kinds of things going on. And that being sort of channeled into backseat activity didn't let them understand anything about each other at all. Then when they found out, divorce, and then you had the things with the children being whatever happened to them. Or if you could speak to that, too. And the third thing, if you get to it, is I have some nephews who are 19, and I can't say that one guy in particular is handsome and all that, and he seems to be doing the same sort of thing all of us were trying back in the 50s, except there seems to be no hostility between the girls after it's over between each other. But, oh, yeah, well, he was nice, wasn't he? That's right. I mean, it just, that one surprises me, and that's probably what's showing my see, recalcitrance, if there is such a thing. Thanks a lot.
Sure. Can you remind me your first question? Because I got the second of the second and the third.
I'm afraid the caller hung up. If we don't get to it, he's certainly welcome to call back and follow up and make sure.
Well, I know he was surprised to hear that we, so few American families fit the so-called homemaker breadwinner pattern, and he wanted me to talk about what life is like today. So, So let me just start there. I think the most important thing to say, which I do say in the book, and which was a surprise to me, is that we tend to think of families as these static entities. And what I found, especially among the generation that's come of age over in the last several decades, is that they don't see families as static types. They see them as what I would call a film, not a snapshot. They are unfolding dynamics that change over time, even when people stay together. And I think once we start to see that, it becomes much easier to understand, to move beyond these notions of traditional families, dual-earner families, and single-parent families, because families are constantly in flux. And the second thing I would add to that concern of your caller is that, and he talked about his own parents breaking up and how they had both essentially abandoned him in the process. And that is a good example of a way in which the breakup is not a good thing. In fact, decidedly a bad thing for the child. Children look back on these parental decisions and ask themselves, what were the consequences? And when parents break up and don't get their lives back together again and don't look after their children, then, of course, it doesn't look like a very good move, and it isn't a good move. And that's what we need to pay more attention to in the society, is if relationships are going to be more fragile, how do we ensure that children, that the continuity of childhood and love and child support gets built into that process rather than letting children fall through the holes in a very holy safety net. The second question was really, I think, about adulthood and the ways in which a young adulthood has now changed. And again, he was comparing his own experiences and those of his parents to young adults today, and he's absolutely right. One of the ways in which we have changed as a society is that we have redefined what we mean by adulthood. It used to be that adulthood meant getting married, becoming sexually active, having children, settling down. Today, and there are many studies to show this, people don't tend to define adulthood as getting married and having children. They define it as becoming autonomous, getting a job, being able to support yourself and take care of yourself. And this is true for women as well as for men. And in that context, sexual relationships change fundamentally in all of the ways that we're seeing. It doesn't make sense for people to postpone sex into their late 20s and early 30s. They have much more control over their reproductive lives. And so our sexual patterns, of course, have changed as well. And that means that the nature of being a late adolescent and young adult is just very different than it used to be. It's not so much, I think, by the way, that our behavior has changed, but that we talk about it and differently and we respond to it differently. I know when I was growing up, there were an awful lot of what we used to call shotgun weddings, where suddenly right after high school or during college, someone would get married and soon thereafter have a child. It's not that people weren't engaging in sex, but we've structured it very differently today so that it doesn't necessarily lead to marriage or, for that matter, to childbearing.
We are just a bit past the midpoint of this hour of Focus 580, and I'd like to introduce again our guests. Kathleen Gerson is professor of sociology and collegiate professor at New York University. She has contributed to various media, including New York Times, Wall Street Journal, Washington Post. She's also been interviewed on National Public Radio, CNN. She's the author of a recently published book. The title is The Unfinished Revolution, How a New Generation is Reshaping Family, Work, and Gender in America. It's published by the Oxford University Press, and is the product of interviews that she did with 120 young women and men between 18 and 32, talking with them about what their family was like growing up and how they felt about that, and then some of their attitudes about family life, what kind of family they think that they would like to have. And so it explores this in some depth, more than certainly we can do here in this hour. And if you would like to read more, you look for the book. Questions are also welcome, 333-9455 and toll-free, 800-222-9455. Email will-talk@illinois.edu. I think probably one of the ways that you might get at the question, how do people feel about the family that they grew up in and whether or not it was a good experience, would be to ask them something like, when you get married and you have a family, do you think your family will be like the one you grew up in? Would that make you happy? Or do you think you'd really like to have a different family from the one where you grew up? If you ask questions that get at things like that, what sort of answers do you get?
Well, here again, I suppose it doesn't sound so surprising once you've looked at the findings that they, about their own parents. But what I found, contrary to the popular concern over the decline of marriage and commitment in America, is that overwhelmingly, regardless of whether you grew up in with two parents or one, whether your mother worked or didn't work, overwhelmingly young men and women want to establish a long-term, lasting, committed, intimate, satisfying relationship with a partner. And in addition, they want to have a fairly egalitarian, what I call flexible relationship with each other, in which they balance work and family in their own lives, and they share it in an egalitarian way with a partner. Now, among women, over 90% of women express this as their ideal, including women from all races, all class backgrounds, and all families types. And men, too. Not as many men, but over two-thirds of men also wanted this kind of a relationship. And, again, didn't matter what kind of a family they grew up in, that's the kind of family they want to live in.
Mm-hmm. This is something that really strikes me, and you can see it in the bar graphs that you've laid out in your book. It's very dramatic. That is, cutting across gender, across family of origin, socioeconomic levels, ethnicity, while there are differences among these groups and there are differences between men and women, the striking thing is the really huge numbers of people who say that what they're looking for in the relationship with their partner is this egalitarian relationship. And while you say it's true that more, that's really important to women, but important to a lot of men as well. And then, you know, it doesn't matter whether you grew up in a traditional family, a dual earner family, a single parent family, whether you're middle class, whether you're working class, way, way more people say, yes, that I want this egalitarian relationship than those people who say that they really are looking for this much more traditional kind of thing.
Right. And almost no one says they want to just stay single forever, which is also, I think, very telling. Yes, and I think whenever we worry about how divided this country is and how different we are and how our values are in conflict, I think that this is an important message for all of us, that at its core, we as a society, and especially among young people, do share certain core values. And they're actually very good values as well. The problem is not so much with our values, but rather with the difficulty we have in achieving those values, given all the obstacles that we face in adulthood. But at the level of how we want to live our lives, it is remarkable and I think very encouraging how much we share.
Mm. Let's take a caller here. Champagne, line one. Hello.
Yes, you've almost covered some of the things that I was going to ask about. I've been close to quite a number of families where there's been a breakup of the family and a movement in other directions in a very amicable way, where the new arrangement is almost an enriching situation for the children and all involved. And it does involve sort of extended family, which is what we used to do hundreds of years ago, with perhaps children born to different parents, and there was a sort of the older population looked after the younger population. It's almost a tribal situation, but I see some of that happening in a very nice way. Could you comment on that?
Yes, I'm glad you brought that up, because one of the key factors that I found that really made a difference in children's lives was exactly that, what I would call the availability of networks of care, especially when parents hit hard times, whether it hard times in their relationships, which often led to a breakup, or and hard economic times as well, when one or both of them lost a job. Those families that could depend on these wider networks of grandparents, relatives, neighbors, friends, where they were able to reach out beyond the household. I won't even call it a nuclear family anymore, because they assume so many different forms, to rely on community bonds and to share in the work of the home made a huge difference. And when that was available, those families did well, even when their parents hit difficult times. And in fact, what I found is that in today's world, where we all face so many uncertainties, uncertainties about work, about the economy, about how relationships will unfold, that it's those wider networks that do provide people with this safety net, if you will, this larger family that helps them through the difficult times and is there for them in good times and bad. And I'll just add one more thing, and that is that many young people, in talking about their own futures, they also saw that as a key, that the way they could figure out how to share equally and to balance work and family and to take care of their children was a hope, if not an expectation, that they could create communities of care, that they could build child care arrangements and exchanges, and that it would be nice if they could look to the community and to social programs to provide that for them.
I think that if you're looking at women especially, as they mature and do go to work and take on a career, there's a mind change which may be very logical and very appreciated by the other partner, and there might be a different direction. And so if you're wanting people to develop their own careers, a musician may go off in a totally different direction. And I think that that's allowable and to be encouraged to some extent.
Exactly. And in fact, even what we think of as quote-unquote ordinary jobs are increasingly, you know, they're in the white-collar sector, they're in the high-tech sector. They're jobs that don't have clear career ladders. They require a lot of flexibility, a lot of moving in and out of work. And men are very aware of this, and it's why they, too, see the benefits of two earners, of having a partner they can rely on and take turns with. So that doesn't have to be this kind of lockstep up the ladder notion of a career. In fact, that notion of a career is increasingly out of date. It's an endangered species, in fact, and we do have to develop new ways of building our adult lives.
All right. I want to thank the caller for the comment. We have about 10 minutes left and would welcome others. We talked a bit earlier about how when you ask people what they're looking for in terms of a family for themselves and their own relationships, that people say they don't want to be alone. They do want to have a partner and be in a long-term committed relationship, and that they like the idea that it's egalitarian in character. Now, I know to me what that means. Is it clear exactly when people say that? Is everybody talking about the same thing?
No, and that's a very good point. And it's not just that men are talking about it one way and women another. I think, in fact, and I don't think this is necessarily a bad thing either, mostly what people mean by egalitarian isn't some toting everything up and adding it up at the end of the day or the week or the month or the year and coming out even. That's a turnoff. Nobody wants to be in a relationship like that. What people mean and what they seek is flexibility and egalitarian sharing over the long run, not necessarily the short run. Taking turns. If your needs go first, this situation, mine go first, the next. It also means the freedom to work it out your way, so that there isn't some cookie cutter notion. In fact, it's quite the opposite of what we used to think of as gender roles. This is what a woman did. This is what a man did. This is what defined, you know, a mother. This is what defined a father. It's, in a sense, a rejection of that whole idea that there are rigid ways of defining what who we are and what we do. And instead, supporting the notion of flexibility, that people can move in and out of different roles, and the blurring of those boundaries, but not some rigid, okay, we've got to be equal on everything, but rather we will work out something that works for us, that feels egalitarian, that both of our needs are taken care of, but that we're also sacrificing for each other.
Well, and I think that of all the things that we've seen happen in a couple decades, I think this is one of the most interesting, that people should arrive at this idea that that's the relationship that they want. As you say, not that they're going to say, half the time you take out the trash and the other time I have to take out the trash.
Right.
But they're saying what they want is a relationship that is a partnership of equals.
Correct.
And that, to me, seems very interesting and very important and sort of invites this question, where did that come from?
Well, that's a very good question. And I think in some ways it's always been there. The interesting thing about American society is that we hold all of these seemingly contradictory values all together in the same place. We're a society that values community, but we're also a society of individualists, right? We value sacrifice, but we also feel that people should be able to be independent and achieve their own needs. We value self-reliance, but we also want people to be there for each other. In some sense, those values have been in tension for a very long time. What has changed is the world we live in. We no longer live in a world that can easily divide men and women up into different groups. In a sense, the traditional family was a way of saying, okay, men get to seek their fortunes and be individualists as long as they have a good work ethic and they plow that back into the family. And women can be the self-sacrificers, the moral defenders of the family, and they will find their own individual fulfillment in that. Well, that particular, what I call moral division of labor, just doesn't work anymore. It doesn't work economically because we don't have an economy to support it, and it doesn't work psychologically because men and women alike want to live fuller lives, don't want to feel cut off from half of themselves. So I see that we've actually reached a very exciting moment in human history when we can bring all of those values together, the values of self-reliance and autonomy and the values of commitment. But it certainly isn't easy, and it's hard to do even in the best of circumstances. But the real challenge in our society is that I think people's hearts and minds are way ahead of our social institutions,
yeah.
And we haven't even begun to talk about how do we change the nature of jobs and the nature of communities so that people can be devoted workers and devoted parents and still have some room for themselves.
What we've been talking about here, in a sense, is the ideal, what it is that people really want, what they would like to have. If you ask people now, what would you be willing to accept? What could you live with short of your ideal? Then what do people say?
Well, that's where things get a lot less uplifting. Unfortunately, among this generation, most of them are quite skeptical about the chances of achieving their ideals. They look around and they see how difficult it is to create the kind of relationship they'd like to have, and they have very high standards. And they worry about jobs and their ability to get steady, secure jobs and their ability to combine steady jobs with family. And in that context, what I found is that this is where I see a new sort of gender divide emerging, not at the level of ideals, but at the level of what I call fallback strategies. What are the ways that young people are living their lives in order to avoid the worst case scenarios if they can't get their best case scenarios? And here what I find is that women especially, contrary to all of the media hype about opting out and heading home, women are seeking what I call self-reliance. They feel the need, the absolute essential need to get good work, to be able to support themselves and any children that they might bear, because they don't think they can depend on marriage the way some women might have been able to do in the mid-20th century. Men, on the other hand, because they're so worried about the pressures on them at work and their need to earn a living and to be a good provider, they fear that they can't be an equal parent and a really involved parent without that risking their work lives. And so men are falling back on what I call a sort of neo-traditionalism, in which they anticipate having a working partner, an employed partner, but they still see themselves as having to be the primary breadwinner and therefore having to cede a lot of the child care to someone else.
Pardon me interrupting you, but is that something that they feel unhappy about, or do they think that that's just kind of the way that it is?
Well, again, let me stress that these are what I call fallback positions. Yeah. They are, they're sort of, you know, trying to make the best of a not perfect situation. The ideal, again, for everyone is to have this sort of flexible sharing, but the fallback position is a way of avoiding the worst. So for a man, the worst case is that he isn't able to support himself or his family and really feels completely at sea and cut off from the possibility of having a work life or a family life. For a woman, the worst case scenario is being left, you know, on her own without the means of supporting herself or her children. So are people unhappy? Obviously, it isn't what they would want in the best of all possible worlds, but it's certainly better than how bad things might get. And so, like all of us, they're trying to navigate this very uncertain, rapidly changing terrain without a clear sense of where they're going, because the paths are not established. And as I said, our economy has not produced sort of new work paths that people can feel secure about, and we haven't begun to think about how do we really care for our children in a context in which women must seek self-reliance and men also need to be able to work in a concerted way as well.
Well, we're done. We have about 2 minutes left to get to the point where here now we've come into the conversation that gets at the title of the book that I've now mentioned a couple of times, Unfinished Revolution. It's certainly the case that things over the last couple of decades have changed. Certainly people's attitudes towards gender have changed, and the way they talk about the relationships they want have changed. At the same time, I think we'd have to say maybe it hasn't changed as much as we'd like to think. I find myself wondering, What's the problem? Is it really individuals' attitudes? Is it the way we think about gender? Or is it the more structural kind of stuff that's really getting in the way?
Well, it's a little of both. But I would argue that that at this point, the structures are more the problem, because people are clearly very flexible. We've grown up they've grown, young people have grown up in an era when they don't even, they can't even imagine going back to something they've never seen. I think what we, the most important lesson we need to take from this is that there really is no going back. For those who are concerned about where we are now, the answer cannot be to go backward. It's not possible economically, and it's not desirable on the part of the young people who are our future. And the real question then is, how do we go forward? I think that that people are ready to really start to entertain a whole new way of thinking about these things. But we are a society that is so diverse, and unfortunately so many of our battles get caught up in political conflicts that leave us stalemated. And that's my biggest concern. How can we overcome the political stalemate to get at what it is that most ordinary Americans really want?
And just real quick to come back to one of the points we started with, that for those people who are really concerned that all this kind of upheaval and family structure that we've seen has been bad for families, and that we have young people now who are down on the idea of marriage, family, children, that's really not the case.
I think in terms of our ideals about family life, they've never been higher. People expect and hope to have rich, vibrant, loving families. And now the challenge is to help them create the social supports they need to create these families. There's no society that can do away with the inherent difficulties of growing up, raising children. This is life, and we know that, and it takes a lot of hard work, and nobody should feel that they're left off the hook. But we can help people get through the more difficult times and come out of them feeling better and stronger rather than defeated by it.
Our guest, Kathleen Gerson, is professor of sociology at New York University. She's the author of The Unfinished Revolution, How a New Generation is Reshaping Family, Work, and Gender in America. The book is out now, and it's published by the Oxford University Press. Professor Gerson, thank you very much.
It's been my pleasure. Thank you.
You've been listening to a program from the Focus Archives. Much of our local production, including past interviews from Focus and local news features, is available on our website anytime that you're ready to listen. Just go to will.illinois.edu. I'm David Inge. Thanks for tuning in.
Today's programs are made possible in part by the Friends of WILL and by 10,000 Villages in downtown Champaign. For over 25 years, 10,000 Villages has provided income to artisans in more than 30 developing countries by marketing their handicrafts and telling their stories in North America. Programs on WILL are made possible by McKinley Presbyterian Church and Foundation, a welcoming faith community that fosters spiritual exploration and works for social change. McKinley is committed to inclusiveness and welcomes all. 5th and John Streets on campus, on the web at mckinley-church.org.
This is Illinois Public Media, WILL, 580 AM and 90.9 FM, HD3 Urbana, online at will.illinois.edu. It's a minute and a half before noon, 34 degrees in Urbana on the campus of the University of Illinois. The sky is cloudy. My name is Celeste Quinn, and I'm here now to bring you up to date on commodity prices. In Kansas City, May wheat trading at 852 and a quarter. That's up 22 and a quarter. July, 863, up 22 and a half. May wheat in Chicago, 732, up 17 and three quarters. July, 768 and a half, up 18 and a quarter. May corn, 695 and a quarter, up 14 and a quarter. July, 701 and three quarters, up 13 and a quarter. September, 653, up 7 and a half. December, 615 and a quarter, up 5 and a half. May soybeans, 1349, down 2 and a quarter. July, 1359, down 2. August, 1357 and a quarter, down 1 quarter. September, 1348 and a half, up 3 and a half. May meal, 358.50, down 150. May oil, 55.66, up 18. April live cattle, 115.40, up 130. June, 114.40, up 105. March feeder cattle, 130.80, up 85. April, 132.55, up 105. April lean hogs, 90.40, up 32 and a half. May crude, 105.86, up 11.
Let's take a look next at the U.S. dollar, 75.59, down 21. The CRB index, 358.13, up 110. The Dow is up 83 points at 12,169.